Hello, and welcome to today's episode of the ABCs, Authors Between the Covers. What makes successful authors tick? What does it take to sell that manuscript? Is self-publishing a good option? Or is selling your book to a big publishing house still the only way to fly? What about keeping up with your first big success? We'll talk about all this and more on today's show, hosted by journalist and publisher Hope Katz Gibbs, author of Truly Amazing Women Who Are Changing the World, and PR Rules, The Playbook. Hi, this is Hope Gibbs. We are here today with David Pendleton, an associate fellow at Sade Business School in Oxford. A chartered psychologist, he specializes in leadership, assessing and coaching senior executives, and developing their abilities to lead, change, and create high-performance cultures. He co-directs the Oxford High Performance Leadership Program with Tim Morris and has made a major contribution to the Oxford Advanced Management and Leadership Program, including a session on leadership and personality and how to assess the potential helping and hindering personality characteristics for leadership. As a consultant, he has worked with a wide range of clients from power, airline, hospitality, retail, pharmaceuticals, healthcare, and professional and financial sectors in Europe, Asia, and America. His most recent book, written with Professor Adrian Furhem of UCI, is called Leadership, All You Need to Know. It was published in 2011 by Palgrave Macmillan, and it highlights the key role played by teams in complementing leaders' abilities. That's what we're here to talk about with the professor, who is currently a visiting professor at the George Herbert Walker School of Business at Webster University here in Washington, D.C. So welcome to the Incandescent Radio Show, David.
Thank you very much.
So we are going to start off by talking about leadership, All You Need to Know. In the book, you say that the successes and failures of leaders are in the media every day. We're in a global political and financial crisis, which is changing how we think about our lives and our futures. And you present a leadership model for the future, which creates the right conditions for people to thrive individually and collectively and achieve significant goals. So tell us all about this model and how especially it applies to entrepreneurs.
Okay, the idea here is that I got quite, frustrated with most approaches to leadership and leadership development. I wish I could show you, but you can't on radio, this wonderful chart which traces, put together by a colleague of mine called Richard Pascal in Oxford, traces the history of thinking about leadership and management from 1950 to 2000. And it shows really two things. One is that there's been the most huge explosion of ideas about both of those subjects since about 1980. So that way back in 1950, you could be a leadership expert and probably know everything that had been written about the subject. But if you tried to do that in 2000, you would be dead before you'd got to the end of the stuff that had even been written by then. And of course, while you were reading, there'd been more stuff written. So it shows that understanding leadership and management takes now a huge amount of time and effort. But the other thing it shows, which is perhaps even slightly depressing, is that in that time, there seem to have been only fads created, fashions. There's no dominant set of ideas that's been accumulating over time. There's simply difference in the ideas. So what I tried to do was to put together an understanding of leadership, which was what I would call the kind of deep structure of all this. In other words, what's underneath all these ideas that might be simple enough for us all to be able to hold in our heads, and which also was building on the research that had happened to date. I reckon it comes down to three major domains that leaders have to operate in. One is the strategic domain, which is all about tomorrow, not concerned with practicalities, it's only concerned with possibilities, things that may be true, something that maybe we could create if we really bust a gut and do something great. Then there's the operational domain, which is all concerned about today and about practicalities. And then there's the interpersonal domain, which is all about the people who are going to be with us on the journey. And what's interesting about that is if you arrange them as a Venn diagram, as three overlapping circles, you begin to understand that although there is difference between the three domains, there are points at which they overlap. And the other thing you realize when you start to dig into the research about leadership is that there's good reason to believe that it's very hard for any one person to be good at all three domains equally, unless they're happy to be mediocre. If you want to be world-class at any one of them, you've probably got to really focus on it, and they require very different mindsets. So if, for example, you think about the strategic domain, think about the strategic mindset. You start with a problem, you go up to a higher level of elevation to get a different take on the picture, you go out to include more issues, and you leap forwards into possible areas that may or may not be helpful. Think about the operational domain. It's a shame they can't see my gestures on the radio, isn't it? But I'm doing the actions, folks. So with the operational domain, what happens is you start with a question, you come down to focus on very specific issues because you don't want to deal with generalities anymore. You go down into the levels of detail and you move forwards, but in small incremental steps. So in the strategic domain, all radical possibilities can be considered. In the operational domain, you only ever deal with incremental change. They're completely different mindsets. They require different kinds of approaches to the problem. And in the interpersonal domain, you've got difference again. You've got emotional intelligence operating. You've got to focus only on the interpersonal, on the people aspects of all issues. And so what you often find is that different people develop different special capabilities in those three domains. And the implications of that are really quite profound. I'm sure there'll be people saying, well, of course, that must be true. That's true. People think of it as intuitively correct. But one, most books you look at about leadership will be focusing on individuals. They'll be saying how you can work on your limitations and become a much more complete leader. I stand in the opposite corner. I say only some of those limitations are you likely to make any progress on, because some of them your personality is working against you. And therefore, when it also comes to another theme that you'll find in the leadership literature, is that people get asked to come on courses on their own or one from each department in an organization. So they've got a kind of horizontal approach to putting courses together. I want to go vertical. I want to say, give me the team. Let's work on the team, because they need each other to be complete. So in a nutshell, my ideas about leadership are this. We have the possibility of creating complete leadership, but we've got to put that together with incomplete individuals.
Very interesting. So let's talk about this concept of incomplete leadership. What does that mean?
It means that if you look at all the capabilities that leaders are required to cover, and you look at the way people come together in packages, I'm of the old ball fat guy variety, the package deal means that it's not possible for me to be infinitely plastic. I can't stretch and change and morph into every aspect of leadership that I'm required to do. So I'm likely to be incomplete if you compare my capability set against the full set that leadership requires. So I'm an incomplete individual, but there's a possibility that working with the right people with complementary differences, we can together provide complementary leadership. The bit that I'm no good at is planning and organizing. I'm here with my colleague, Sean Coleman from Webster University. He's very, very good at it. Together, we can be dangerous. But on my own, I'm a bit of a damp squib when it comes to organizing things.
Interesting. So how can organizations, especially small businesses, be more effective using your principles?
I'd urge people, if you've got a very small business, and therefore you're dealing with, you know, one, two, or three, or four people, if it's literally a handful of people, you may not be spoiled for choice in terms of the range of capabilities that you've got. But you need to take this idea that I am on my own unlikely to have everything that I need to lead well. Mm-hmm. So the first thing I'd say is understand what you bring to leadership. The ideas in my book on leadership simply provide a checklist of the things that you need to be able to do well. I can say them in 8 simple lines. Set strategic direction, create alignment, plan and organize, build and sustain relationships, work effectively in teams, and deliver results. That's only 7, plus 1, which is about coping with pressure. I say plus one because if you think about my three overlapping circles, I've just described the seven zones that Venn diagram creates. The one in the middle, incidentally, we call leading, which is about balancing the other leadership contributions. The coping with pressure sits outside all of that because it's the pressure that acts on us that sometimes causes us to buckle and break. So the first thing I'd say is have a look at that list of leadership capabilities and be very realistic about the ones that you bring and the ones you don't bring. Then secondly, consider in your team, do you have people who can do the other things? And they don't have to be hugely senior people. So for example, the majority of my planning and organization is done by my PA. And she's terrific. She's a very, very smart and sunny lady. Every day she's got a smile on her face, which I love. But the great thing is that when it comes to planning and organizing, you'd wonder who was the boss, because she tells me what to do. I set the direction, and I say, within that, Natalie, could you please sort this out? And she tells me what I must do in order to make the plan work. And at that point, she's got the baton. And that's fine. I'm comfortable with that. So it may be that there's someone in your organization, but it may be that it's someone in another organization, or maybe a family member or someone else. You have to be quite realistic about where you will find these people. And it may be that it's in a professional association. Maybe you're a member of a chamber of commerce. Maybe you can share some of the capabilities between your small organizations. My consulting firm is a very niche firm called the Edgecombe Consulting Group, and it applies psychology to the world of work. There are only 23 of us in the firm. So it's not exactly a big organization. But when we were much smaller, we struggled to find the particular skill set that we needed. But having the ideas about leadership clearly in mind that we were evolving, we went shopping very specifically for not just, for example, someone could be an office manager, but someone who could be an office manager whose planning and organizing skills were strong, or someone who could lead our corporate practice whose ability to create alignment was strong. So we had these two shopping lists. There was the kind of, what do they need to be able to do? We want an accountant, you know, or we want a bookkeeper, or we need a whatever. But we also knew that there was this leadership capability set that we needed to complete as well. So we went shopping for one person with things from both lists, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. So let's talk a little bit more about leadership. Do mm-hmm. you think that people are born leaders? Is it a skill they can learn? Or is it something that some people just are team players by nature and they don't want to lead?
The evidence on are leaders born or made is a definite yes. In other words, they are born or made, and usually both born and made. But not to be facetious about it, I'm quite serious. You will be, if not born with, certainly by the time you've reached adulthood, equipped with a personality which is unlikely to change very much. If you're not an extrovert, if you're an introvert, in order to lead, you've got to emulate some aspects of extroversion. So, extroverts most naturally spend time with people. They like to network with people. It's natural for them to do so. Extroversion is associated with assertiveness. It's also associated with optimism. These things don't come so naturally to the introvert. Now, does that mean introverts can't lead? No, it doesn't. But it means they've got to invest an awful lot of energy and focus. They've got to stretch to find those characteristics. And those are not quite born, but they're certainly acquired and fairly stable by adult life. But can leaders improve the quality of their leadership? The answer to that is yes as well. And there's all sorts of ways in which they can do that, but not least by getting good people around them. So there's a whole variety of ways in which I'd say leaders are both born and made.
Mm-hmm. And do you think some people really enjoy being part of the team as opposed to being the leader?
Yeah, I think particularly in the world of work, it's interesting, you know, if you look at an awful lot of mums who don't live to work, but they work to live, many dads too, but I think still slightly more particularly women, will come into the workplace because they want to take fantastic care of their family and also earn some money to help them do that well. And of course, what's actually happening is they've got a leader hat on at home, mm-hmm. but they don't want to take that responsibility on in the workplace. You know, they've got enough on. So what I do feel is that some people have an agenda in their lives, which mean they don't want to get involved in leadership in the workplace, even though they may take it on elsewhere. You know, they may be the mainstay of the Parent Teacher Association at school. They might be a local, you know, counsellor, you know, but what they can't afford to do is when they pitch up to the office every day, they just haven't got any more libido left to invest in leading in the workplace. Yeah.
And that segues beautifully into something we were talking about before the interview about your belief that this is the millennia of the future, that women are the leaders of the future.
Yes. There is a famous saying that the 19th century belonged to Britain because the British Empire turned the world's atlases pink, and the 20th century belongs to the United States as its economic dominance was established. And therefore, the 21st century, goes the saying, belongs to China. I believe, actually, that the 21st century belongs to women. And the reason for that is I think that our world has experimented for an awfully long time now with simple, naked, bald competition. And that's still very much more the province of men than women. Certainly in most OECD countries, women are brought up much more to be collaborative rather than competitive and so on. And I still remember a lovely soap opera in my country in which men and women sat around debating the women's book group. And the men, the husbands in the group, said, we're going to start a book group as well. And so tell us how to do it. And the lady said, well, we all sit around and we decide what book to read. And the guy said, yep, we've made a note of that. And then they said, well, so then we read the book. And they said, yeah, I've made a note of that. And he said, and then we just discuss the book. And he said, yes, I've made a note of that. And then we choose another book. And the guy said, wait a minute, you mean nobody wins? and so it does seem to me that what we need increasingly is words like partnership, collaboration, nurture, growth. And these replace an old vocabulary about competition, you know, win-lose. You know, there's an awful lot that's moving in the direction of requiring boundaries of organizations to get more sort of permeable, corporate structures to be more fluid, organizations finding ways of collaborating, not just to cost share, but maybe to capability share as well, so that one of the big debates I have often at the moment is on about a program that we've started between Oxford and Harvard. You know, it's a very unnatural thing for these two business schools to collaborate with each other. And every now and again, we find someone who hates the idea that we're doing that. Aren't we complete in and of ourselves? I've been slightly irritating people, particularly one person that I was having a big debate with in Harvard. You know, we are Harvard Business School. We don't need to collaborate with anybody. He said, we're 100 years old, you know, and we just are complete ourselves. And I said, you know what? We used to have that view at Oxford. And when we got to about 500 or 600 years old, we decided we could relax a little. And, you know, but what I was trying to say really was a serious point, which was that what we've got to do in the 21st century is not only encourage participation, collaboration, partnership, but maybe even model it as well.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the next generation who's going to take over the workforce, the millennials, and how you feel they will or will not change the workforce of the future.
I think that the thing I've noticed about leaders and the study of leadership through the years, and I've done it in the book I did, the first chapter is all about where's the history of the study of leadership been. What I've noticed is that leadership seems to reflect the mores of the time. You know, so if you look at Taylorism at the beginning of the 20th century, Taylorism was a very hierarchical approach to leadership and management in which super smart people did the really creative strategic thinking and everyone else did as they're told. And it came from an era when the world was very authoritarian and hierarchical. If I think about the United Kingdom at that time, you know, the society would be almost unrecognizable. You'd think that people from another planet, if you were to compare it with the early 21st century, which is where we are now. The world before the First World War was a strictly hierarchical world. You know, there were aristocrats in the United Kingdom. The middle class was very small, and there's a big working class. And people would touch their forelocks when the squire came past, as it were. So not surprisingly, the leadership at the time reflected those mores. If you compare that with the 21st century, I mean, we've passed through the 60s, as we were saying earlier. You know, the old saying goes that if you can remember the 60s, you weren't joining in. But certainly the idea of the 60s, and it was a particular decade that strikes me as being important in the US and in Europe. There were major protests about the way the world was at that time. Partly it was provoked by Vietnam, but partly it was provoked simply by the authoritarian world needing to give way to a generation, the baby boomers, who were much more seeking to be participative. And of course, what's happened is that now it's the baby boomers that are standing in the way, people like me. You know, it's the people who are in power. The next generation always wants to question, move out of the way, seek room to move, and so on. I believe that human beings are human beings, and I think what's going to happen with the millennials is that it feels like they're a different generation right now, but wait till they're in their 50s. I'll bet you they'll be the people that the next generation will want to move out of the way. And it seems to me it's just in the nature of humankind that generations, you know, want to find room for their contributions. What I'm hopeful for with the next generation is that the pace at which old assumptions are being questioned and the pace at which old structures are being changed has itself accelerated. And so it feels to me as if any organization or individual or team that wants to succeed in the 21st century is going to have to embrace flexibility. It's going to have to embrace change, because one thing's for sure, all that's going to happen with change is it's going to speed up.
Right. Yep, and everyone says that. So tell us a little bit more about your career. How did you go from being a psychologist to doing what you're doing today?
Well, I've not really stopped being a psychologist. I've just simply applied it to different walks of life throughout my career. I started out applying psychology to the world of education, and I've early in my career trained teachers. I then applied it to the world of medicine. I did my doctorate on the subject of doctor-patient communication, but in the experimental psychology department at Oxford. And so I, for a number of years, applied psychology to the world of medicine. And then thirdly, I got recruited into a management consultancy. So I started to apply psychology to the world of commerce. And in the last 10 years, I've located the issue that really turns me on. It's the issue of leadership. So I'm really still a psychologist, but I'm just applying it to different fields of applied endeavor.
Excellent. So tell us a little bit more about what you're doing here in Washington at Webster, and we're going to loop Sean Coleman in, who runs the program at Bowling Air Force Base. So what are you up to while you're here in the States?
I've been made visiting professor at Webster University, which is headquartered in St. Louis, but is very active in various different parts, not only of the U.S., but around the world. And Sean Coleman, my colleague here today, is the regional director for Webster here in this part of the world. And we're trying to take this message out to anyone who will listen. We haven't quite been to the shopping malls yet, but you know, you may see me in a sandwich board down in some shopping mall or other. But what I really want to do is to get people to think about the implications of incomplete individuals, but the need for complete leadership. And Sean has arranged an exhausting program of talks and interviews, even with charming people, who give me an opportunity to talk a little bit about a different way of thinking about leadership.
Excellent. And Sean, tell us, what attracted you to David? Why did you want to bring him into Webster's program? And what has happened since he's been here? What kind of response is he getting?
Well, let me start with the last part of that. The response has just been overwhelming. I have been working him hard, but that was the mandate I was given. And, you know, we've been from Southern Maryland to all around the Washington, D.C. area. Last night he spoke to 50 government accountants in a hotel room downtown or down in Alexandria. And the response was just incredible as he laid out the model of leadership that he discussed earlier in the interview. Tomorrow we're going to be in Southern Maryland talking to a select group of business leaders about what are the change issues that are coming down the pike, and how can they better adapt their organizations to that? I wanted to bring David to DC because David was the perfect venue upon which to tell the Webster story. Webster's been around for almost 100 years. We celebrate our 100th birthday in 2015. We've been in DC for 26 years. We have four campuses, but nobody knows who we are. Nobody knows that we're the third-ranked business school in the Washington, DC area. U.S. News and World Report came out about a month to 6 weeks ago with a list of the top 199 business schools in the country, and we were ranked 66th. But when you disaggregate that down into regions, we were ranked third here in the Washington, D.C. area. But nobody's heard of us. So we wanted to bring David, really give us an opportunity to reach out to the business community, reach out to other communities of interest to us, to highlight the quality of the education that Webster brings at such a reduced price. Our master's degree program, and it's principally adult master's degree programs that we offer, are at about a third the price of what you will find at most of the universities in the area. And that's a huge bargain in an era when our education debt now exceeds our household income debt. And so Webster has a great story to tell about the value proposition of education. You know, we are a not-for-profit institution, so our first concern is student success. Our last concern, not a concern, is the money piece of the puzzle. And we have a great story to tell. The value of a visiting scholar such as David really underscores that type of message. And that's why I wanted to bring David here, and why I have been exhausting him from sunrise to sunset, and the days are only getting longer, over this past week. So, yeah.
I have to tell you that my co-author, Adrian Furnham, from University College London, is the world's, the UK's most cited social scientist. And he always, when he and I are speaking together, he always says, David and I are called gurus, but only by people who can't spell charlatan.
Well, we hardly think that's the case, and we're really excited to have your leadership ideas on Be Incandescent Magazine's April issue and on the Incandescent Radio Network. So we hope that everyone gets to take a look at your book, Leadership, All You Need to Know, and definitely check out Webster University, which is a great deal if you're in the market for a business degree. So thank you so much for taking a listen on the Incandescent Radio Network. Thank you for being here with us, David and Sean.
Thank you.
We were thrilled that you made a stop here on our network while you were in the United States.
That's it for today's episode of the ABCs, Authors Between the Covers, hosted by journalist and publisher Hope Katz Gibbs, author of Truly Amazing Women Who Are Changing the World and PR Rules, The Playbook. Be sure to check back next week on the Incandescent Radio Network for another interview with a successful author who is happy to share their story. Here's to writing your heart out and keeping your dreams alive. Thanks so much for listening.